with Sophie Black.
Hello and welcome back. My guest this week is the comedy writer and presenter Danny Robbins. He is best known for his sitcom, radio sitcom Rudy's Rare Records, that starred Lenny Henry and went on for four series on Radio 4. He also used to work with Marcus Brigstock and Dan Tetzel. They wrote The Museum of Everything. That may be quite niche, but that's what I remember him first from. He's done lots of comedy and lots of writing, travel writing as well. And he also has two young children. His wife is Swedish, which is why he can pronounce baby Bjorn properly. And I'm afraid, apologies for the poor sound quality on this one. I think I've done my best and it's quite listenable, but sadly, it is quite echoey because I used a dodgy cable for loyal listeners. It's the same dodgy cable that I used for my Jenna Russell interview, which I'm now going to cut up so I don't accidentally use again. Anyway, when Danny came to talk to me, I asked him what his expectations of parenthood were.
I think my expectations were very much based upon looking at the quite small number of people at that time around me who had children and thinking I didn't want to be like them. And seeing people's lives change and seeing, like, for instance, I used to play volleyball every week, and there was one guy who I think was probably the only one of our group who had a kid, and he came in looking exhausted and stressed every day, and if you ever saw him out in public, he looked like, you know, his life was crumbling around him. And I thought, that's not going to be me. And I think particularly as somebody who works by themselves and depends on your brain working sharply for your creativity, I was quite nervous about that idea that I might lose my superpowers, that a baby would be kryptonite and I'd lose my creativity, or I'd just be too tired to write. And so I think I very stubbornly in myself felt, I'm not going to let this baby change me. And as you realise very quickly after that happens, you know, that's not possible. But I think I held on to that perhaps for longer than I should, I think. And
right.
I think we were lulled into a false sense of security by our first child being very calm and really portable. So I remember taking him to... We sat in the Nou Camp Stadium in Barcelona watching a Champions League match.
Whoa.
With this sleeping baby in a baby BN sling in front of me, with screaming Catalan people all around us going, come on, Barca, and he slept
That's
through the whole
amazing.
Match, and it was kind of strange, you know, and bizarre. But you know, we'd take him to restaurants, we'd take him to weddings and parties, and he was just so calm, and so I think we got lulled into this thing that actually our lives weren't changing.
Yeah,
and I remember still sitting in the pub with Eva, my wife, and having a pint, and eating pizza, and we put a napkin over Leo's head, so this napkin would sit on the head of him whilst he was in the baby Bjorn, and we'd eat pizza over his head.
I've done that, definitely.
and drink our beers, and it definitely felt like there was this nice honeymoon period of things not changing. And then, of course, the point kicked in where he was waking every hour in the night and exhausted, and things changed. And I think that I carried on for too long thinking things wouldn't change, and I think to a point where that created a little bit of a tension with Eva, my partner, I think, And I think this is something that I see around me a lot, I think. And I think I see a lot of bad examples in daddom of how you should be a dad. And so many dads said to me, like, oh, you know, it's all right, really. You know, I've been sleeping in the spare room, and, you know, my wife gets up to do most of the feeds, and, you know, things haven't really changed that much. And, she's very understanding. You know, I have to go off to work and all that sort of thing. And I think there is a period where the mum's innate instinctive maternal instincts are kicking in, and sort of, you know, she is keeping that baby alive. And because it's a new thing, she's kind of accepting the dad saying, like, you know, I've got to go off to work and I'm earning money for the family, and I'll just sleep in the spare room and that sort of thing. But actually, it's not really acceptable. And I think sometimes dads have to have this explained to them, and you have to be physically wrenched out of your complacent belief that this is what dads do, and that dads' lives continue one way normally and mums don't.
Yeah.
I think as much as we're seeing a shift in and a kind of realignment of gender relationships and what it means to be a man and a woman, I think that probably in my group of friends, most people were locked into these kind of quite traditional relationships. And there's a lot of societal and historic pressure on guys to be one way and women to be a different way. And, you know, like that thing Piers Morgan said about Daniel Craig, about him being a sissy or something like that for wearing a sling, having his baby in a sling. And it's so toxic. But that kind of thing is very pervasive. And the idea that the man shouldn't take much time off work and, you know, you rush back after a quick 2 weeks paternity leave. And as a freelancer, I had no paternity leave. I took 2 weeks off work, which set me massively back in the project I was doing. And you know, there's no kind of safety valve or thing that takes you out of your work.
Yeah.
But I think men need to have it explained to them. I think, you know, it came to a point with Eva and I where it built to a head, really. And this was actually after our second child, where she was kind of getting ground down by it all and feeling quite stressed and depressed about it all. And she said to me, you know, this isn't fair. You know, it's not fair for you to prioritise your career. You've been prioritising your career for the last 4 years since the birth of our first child, and I haven't. And and it had to be explained to me in those terms. And when she said that, I was like, you're right. That's, you know, inarguable. Yeah. And since then, I've gone down to working 4 days a week and just... You know, I'm around. I do the drop-offs in the morning and the pick-ups in the afternoon. And, and because I'm writing at home, I can do that and I can be around more. But I really did feel like it was a massive wake-up call. And actually...
What was the thing? How did she explain it in a way that made the penny drop? What was the thing that made you realise that?
Well, I mean, it was quite a serious moment. I mean, she was very upset and she was saying, like, you know, things need to change, you know, and yeah, it's hard. And now I see a lot of dads around, good friends who have just had babies, and I hear them saying lines that I can remember myself saying about, you know, oh, Eva's being so good. You know, she's doing all the getting up in the night and, I'm sleeping in because I've got to go to work. And I just kind of see them going down this road that's eventually going to lead to a point where there is this tension where the woman feels things are unequal and that she's been kind of ground down, because you do get ground down by the routine of looking after kids. And but if you're doing it all yourself, you're going to get build up this huge ball of resentment.
Yeah, it is such a, it's so hard, because the way I always see it is that it sort of, your life changes so hugely, but you're not used to, you know, as I say, you're kind of too sleep deprived, or it's too new to be able to step back and kind of go, right, hang on, this isn't fair, why don't you do this and I do this, and da, da, da. So you kind of stumble through it, and before, and then what happens is that the mother inevitably, because she's been doing it most of all, is better at it, so then it just stays, because the mother can't be bothered to let the father try. So I know definitely, you know, against myself, you know, I know there were times where actually I could have let David do something, in inverted commas, badly. And I didn't, because I'd rather just do it myself. And actually, that was crap, because, you know, the more that then the father does it, the better he is at doing it, you know.
But the stakes feel so high, don't they? Yeah. You feel like you're keeping this thing alive.
Totally.
You
know, or keeping them alive, or also, you know, if it takes me 20 minutes to get them to sleep and it takes him an hour and a half, well, I'd rather have more time with him in the evening, didn't we? You know, so it's like, it's really complicated, and it's not straightforward. And the main thing is, with the basic domestic labour, as for want of a better word, a lot of that is where you get your closeness with your kids. So although it might be something you don't want to do, actually the kind of, like, for instance, him taking the kids to nursery every morning is a brilliant space for them to kind of have their own little things that they do, and they chat about in the car on the way, and that is so valuable, that if you don't ever have a point in your day like that and you think, brilliant, my wife's picking it all up, you're like, yeah, but you're missing out on a chance at intimacy with your kids.
Totally. I think you have to invest to reap the benefits, you know, and I think you do see massive sea changes as a dad, where suddenly you get to be doing something like taking them to nursery or spending a day a week with them, and see what comes back at you. And I think, you know, for the early days of childhood, of parenthood, being a dad can feel quite a lonely place.
Yeah.
You feel very inadequate a lot of the time. You are doing things less well than a mother. You don't kind of had the same maybe sort of instinctive connection with a baby. And not, I've got, I mean, you are useless to an extent. I mean, if the mother is breastfeeding, then you can't feed that child. There's nothing you can really do.
Yeah.
And I remember a friend saying to me about, you know, saying, what's it like having a baby and, you know, do you really love them? And he was like, no, I didn't really love them until kind of a few months in, you know. And, you know, you don't really get to know them properly as a dad until a few months in when you can start to do a bit more and, yes. and feel a bit more hands-on.
And that they can give a bit back to you. I mean, that sounds very narcissistic, but, you know, that as they get older, then they're responding to you and you can actually have a sort of relationship beyond feeding kind of thing.
I think you see a lot on, like, Facebook, for instance, these pictures of newborn babies and a message from the you know, the parent, normally the dad, I guess, because the mother's still recovering.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, like, we're deliriously happy, we're so in love, adoring. And I mean, yes, there is that amazing moment, but in terms of that real strong deep love for your child, I think that kicks in later. I think there's moments where you kind of go like, oh my goodness, wow, this is an incredible being, who's, particularly when they start talking, I think, when they start being able to articulate a personality.
Yeah.
So I feel like your love deepens and grows over time.
I think that's so true. And I think maybe when people remember having their children, then they look back on, like, wow, that was the moment where our lives changed forever. But actually, in the moment, I remember being quite strangely out of body conscious of the fact that I didn't feel that. And it wasn't, you know, I didn't have postnatal depression. I wasn't, you know, it wasn't anything. But yeah, I remember with that thinking, oh, this is an amazing experience, but I don't feel what I've heard I should feel at this moment. It was a very physical thing. Mm. And I was being very practical about, you know, about things. And I wasn't, whereas in fact, David, I just have this amazing image of him sitting in a chair holding Zach, just crying and going, I love you so much. You know, it's beautiful. Whereas I was kind of like, right, okay, the presenter, you know what I mean? All this kind of stuff, you know.
Yeah, we've been through such a horrendous ordeal. We went through 60 hours of labour with Leo. It spanned.
When you say we.
Well, okay, yeah, with me standing around being largely useless. I remember, you know, we'd gone through that all, you know, ridiculous really birth plan kind of thing of this is how we're going to do it, and we were going to have aromatherapy candles, and I'd made a playlist of music, get into the hospital, and they say, well, clearly you can't have candles, it's a hospital, you can't have a naked flame in it. I'm like, oh, but the, you know, they said in the book, you know, and Eva didn't want to listen to any music, she was just like, stop it, shut up.
Yeah.
And but we've been through 60 hours of that, and then at the end of that,
60 Leo, hours.
Yeah, I know. And then Leo was kind of ill as a result of that, and he wasn't well, and he went into the intensive care thing. So certainly I don't think there's a lot of nostalgic memories of the actual birth there. And I think that there is a lot of nostalgia about babies amongst those who have older kids. And I think, in a way, maybe it's partially to do with the fact that parenting engenders anxiety. We feel anxious. Yeah, we feel like we're making mistakes. And a baby is a blank canvas. You know, you haven't made any mistakes by that point. So if you've got kids who you're like, oh, I'm a bit worried, they're a bit shy, or he's a bit strange, you know, he's sort of, you know, I'm concerned about his behaviour, then going back to babydom, you have none of that.
No, and that's
it's
so true.
Uncharted territory, you know, kind of, you know, tabula rasa. I grew up in 1980s Newcastle, and I remember being 4 or 5 and having a teacher who specifically kept a tennis ball in the classroom so he could throw it at us, and also threw board rubbers and chalk.
At 4 or 5?
Yeah, no. And you know, I also remember, like, I was the only vegetarian in my school. You know, this was a kind of freakish thing in the Northeast in the 1980s. And I was also a bit of a picky eater, and this headmistress of the school, and again, I was probably about 5, and she didn't like the fact I wouldn't eat baked beans. And she said, what don't you like about them? And I said, I didn't like the tomato sauce. And the next day she came in and she drained these baked beans of tomato sauce and stood over me and forced me to eat cold, drained saucepans of baked beans in this really sadistic, nasty way, and I was weeping into the beans.
Oh, my God!
Yeah, so, I mean, I'd sort of, you know, my childhood was riven with these memories of adults being quite cruel, you know, kind of unreasonable, you know, and then going into secondary school later on, you know, having kind of outlandish people who would, like, go and drink whiskey in cupboards and wring wet paper towels over people's heads, and a teacher who lined boys up and punched them in the stomach to test their reflexes, you know. And,
you know, oh, my God!
And I think, you know, this kind of quite sort of hardcore existence in kind of, you know, the northeast of the 1980s had sort of primed me to kind of have quite low expectations of what my child might expect in the world, you know. And I think Eva, on the other hand, came from very progressive, very touchy-feely Sweden, where you don't start school until you're seven. Yeah. You know, like, she couldn't read until she was seven. You know, yeah. She started school, and, you know, where school, I guess, is much more, you know, along the lines of, you know, kind of a Steiner school here, where it's, yeah. You know, school is much more about engendering play and creativity early on in life, certainly up to the age of seven. And then, and I think, yeah, and also in Sweden, there's just, you know, parenting in general is a different kettle of fish. Like, you know, we constantly look to Scandinavia for examples of how to do things well, I think, you know. You know, it's this place that is both familiar in some ways, it's a society recognizably similar to our own, but they just seem to be like a better version of us.
Yeah.
And they've certainly got parenting cracked. Childcare is 10 times cheaper, I worked out. So if you pay, like, you know, £100 a week for your childcare, you pay £100 a month pretty much in Sweden or whatever.
Yeah, right.
You know, I mean, certainly we were shelling out, like, on a nursery, before we got the 30 hours free care, we were shelling out like £800 a month on nursery. They don't pay anything near that. And
I think we have one of the most expensive childcare systems in the world. So ours is particularly bad, but yeah.
Which, again, enforces this gender thing of, like, the men go off to work, the woman stays at home.
Yeah, because you can't afford, you know, you have to be earning quite a lot of money to justify.
And in Sweden, they really did actively socially engineer to make sure that women would go back to work.
Yeah.
So they've got this thing now where, I mean, they've had it for a long time, which was about you get 480 days of paternity leave.
Yeah.
And it has to be shared.
Yes. I've heard about this, and that you, and because they tried it first of all where it could be shared, but then it never was. And then they were told, well, if the father doesn't take his share, you lose it.
Exactly.
And then suddenly everyone was going, well, I mean, that would be wasteful, that would be stupid. And that, you know, and it had a huge take up. But the you know, going back to what we're talking about in terms of love and the labor that goes into, you know, that, just the huge benefit to your kids and to you as a father.
Yeah, it's brilliant
to feel more part of.
It's brilliant. That. So all Swedish dads have, I think they've got to have 3 months, or it might even be 6 months, but certainly they have a big chunk of time they have to take off work. And because it's normal, no employers bulk at this.
And there are other dads around. I know a few dads who did shared parental leave, but it's quite rare. And I always, and this is awful because I have lots of brilliant male friends and all this kind of thing, but there'd be a sea of women and one sort of, you know, guy walking in with a sling, and you just think,
well, certainly, I mean, you know, where I live in Walthamstow, and I see loads of posters all around saying mum and baby classes, come and do mum and baby yoga. And it's still very, very enforced that it's not dads.
And
I know a lot of dads, I was speaking to one the other day, actually, he said he'd been made to feel consistently really weird going into these groups, like he was some kind of, like, almost like some sort of sex pest walking into a kind of thing.
And also it's hard because your conversation, your level of conversation at that point is shit. Like, it's really terrible. And the only thing you can talk about, you know, is breastfeeding or, you know, like, so suddenly I think I felt fear when I saw, you know, I mean this against myself, but, you know, that you know, someone would, I think, God, what am I going to talk to him about? And maybe there's an awful assumption where I'd think, well, he'd find it boring if I'm talking about feeding, whatever. Actually, he's in the same zone, so... But that must be really hard.
Well, I remember that being one of the things about early parenthood, actually, that I did feel it was quite lonely. And I felt like Eva had made a lot of friends through these groups. She had lots of mum friends.
Yeah.
And I hadn't made any dad friends. And I could see amongst a lot of other dads I'd sort of bump into places, a kind of a little bit of a standoffishness, a kind of defensiveness of like, you know, essentially anxiety, of kind of feeling a bit insecure. And it took a long time before I started, I'd chat to people on Saturday mornings in playgrounds, because Saturday morning in Walthamstow seemed to be this kind of strange, like, you know, as if women had been abducted, you know, and it was just like, it was just dads wandering around in playgrounds looking slightly lost. Like,
we had that with swimming classes. Yeah, we had that with swimming classes where suddenly all the dads were in the pool.
But as soon as I started making friends with other dads, everything felt a bit more manageable and a bit like, you know, you had some sort of support network. And in Sweden, they have this thing, latte pappas.
Yes, I've heard
of this. These dads who meet up in the cafes together and push their, you know, expensive buggies around and have their baby beer and slings, you know. I mean, it's just, if you normalize something, then that's, I mean, that's the way to do it, isn't it? Because at the moment, you know, it still feels a bit odd.
Yeah.
For dads, you know, I mean, if you walk through a park in Sweden and you see dads pushing buggies everywhere.
Yeah.
And here you just don't. You kind of look at this person, you think, oh, I wonder why he's not working.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I remember going to a restaurant in Gothenburg and getting chatting to the guy who ran it, and he was saying, oh, it's been a little bit difficult recently. My chef's off for a year. And I was like, oh my God, what's happened to him? Has he had an accident? You know, he's like, no, it's just normal. It's, you know, it's paternity leave. But that idea of being off for a year. And then going back to your job as normal.
Yeah.
I mean, it obviously puts, it does put a pressure on businesses. And if you were a small company trying to cope with even one employee having that, but let alone if it was two or three at the same time, it would be challenging, I guess.
Yeah. But then you've got, I mean, I know, you know, I mean, I think, well, the theory is that you invest in someone seriously, i.e., support them while they have families, and then what they give back to you is an incredible loyalty that you wouldn't get, you know, so that actually that I think, well, that's the theory, isn't it?
I went to Estonia and they have 3-year paternity leaves. So
what?
I met a woman who had had
two kids, I think.
Yeah, I mean, she'd had two kids and she hadn't worked for 6 years. You know, that seemed to me the other end of the spectrum where potentially that's bad, that's taking someone out of real life and, you know, contact with other people for too long.
Yes.
I think the Swedish thing was very much about wanting equality.
Yes.
You know, it's a society that's fundamentally based on equality, social equality, gender equality, racial equality, you know, and it's a kind of model of that. And so they actively saw a problem of, you know, women are not getting back into the work system enough, you know, or quickly enough, or even at all. And so they decided to change things, and they have successfully changed that now.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, that's, that goes across a whole swathe of things. You know, you look at adverts for cleaning products, and it's men advertising the cleaning product, you know, a man vacuuming, you know. You don't see that kind of constant enforcement of the female being the one who's looking after the house. I mean, there are critics of it as well. You know, I read a really interesting book called The Almost Nearly Perfect People by a British journalist who lives in Denmark, which is this interesting exploration of each of the Nordic countries. And
I think I've read a bit. I haven't read the book, but I did a travel piece about Denmark, and I think I did speak to him. Yeah,
but he talks about how there is this kind of theory within Sweden that is that children are separated from their parents at a very early age. You know, the mother goes back to work very quickly, and you know, the paternity leave can be sort of spread out in different ways. You know, so it's not necessarily a block of somebody having that child for a whole time. But they go off to this thing, Dagis, which is kindergarten, nursery, quite early. You know, and often babies are there. You know, and he was talking about this kind of theory that, you know, it sort of breaks down the parental bond. You know, and that actually, you know, in Sweden, that you have this stronger bond with the state, with society. You know, that Swedes are taught to be Swedes. They're taught to be citizens of Sweden, and this kind of collectivist.
So they don't have
hive mentality. So that your bond with individuals, and again, he was sort of citing, you know, the quite large divorce statistics in Sweden.
Right.
That individual bonds between people, be it husband and wife, you know, parent and child, are less important than that between the individual and the state. And it's the state that looks after you. The state nurtures you through life and gives you generous benefits and, you know, all these things, which, you know, is a theory that plenty of people will want to leap on and trample to death.
But,
But, you know, it's interesting. I think there is a different approach to things in general in Sweden. I see a lot less sentimentality in Sweden. They are just fundamentally less sentimental people, and I think I see less sentimentality attached to parenting and childhood, but also less anxiety.
Yeah,
you know, and there's a kind of cliche of Swedes leaving their kids sleeping outside in their buggies, in the snow or whatever, wrapped up warm. And I think,
why is that? Because I keep remembering that, because they do that in Denmark as well. Why is that good again? Why do they do? What's the reason for it?
I don't know. I mean, they're very wrapped up and insulated in very sort of sensible, good winter clothing. But
is it done because it's healthy, or it's just it doesn't matter?
It's a really good question. I don't know. I mean, I guess they think the fresh air is healthy, but I can't imagine any scientific proof
for
that.
Yeah.
But it's an example, I guess, of not worrying about your kid. I think British parents would be flapping about, oh, they're going to get a cold.
Yes.
We, to some degree, either definitely don't want to or definitely do want to give our kids the childhood we had.
Yeah.
If you've had a nice childhood, you want to give them your childhood.
Yeah.
And if you didn't, then you're desperate to avoid it.
Or to do the opposite.
Yeah. And I think Eva had a nice childhood, and, you know, she had a very idyllic childhood, really, in this very small town in Sweden. Her dad was the mayor of the town.
Yeah.
And, you know, was a teacher at her school, and it's a tiny little place, and it's very beautiful. And I think she does sometimes wonder, is she doing the right thing in not giving her children that childhood?
Yeah,
I don't know. I mean,
and how does your sort of northeastern 80s, you know, hardcore kid, you know, tortured by teachers kind of childhood, how does that come into your... does that inform your parenting style?
I don't know. Yeah, it does a bit. I mean, like, I'm like, you know, appalled at the idea of my son going off to do PE in trousers. I'm
right.
Like, yeah, get your shorts on. Come on, son. What are you doing, man? And I don't know. I mean, like, yeah, I'm a sort of... I guess it makes me a little bit more sort of like, just, oh, come on, get on with it. You know, like,
yeah,
you know,
right.
It's
yeah,
not that
yeah.
bad. But, I mean, I had a happy childhood. I mean, I kind of liked all of that in a weird way. I sort of feel like it made me a kind of fairly durable person who could kind of take these things. But I don't know. I mean, again, you know, when I meet people who grew up in London, I always felt like, particularly when I arrived at university and met them, I felt like they seemed so much more sophisticated than me. Like, I felt like, you know, Newcastle is a city, but it feels to some degree a bit like a small town. And then you can, I used to walk home every night from a night out. I never had that thing of traversing a city by bus or tube, you know.
Yeah.
And so I definitely feel like my kids growing up in London will grow up much more precocious and sophisticated, and they will mature much quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly in a world where you feel like children are maturing too quickly anyway because of, you know, wanting to ditch their toys and have iPads, or, you know, that horrendous thing of, you hear of, you know, 8-9-year-olds being shown porn, you know. You know, I guess there's a bit of me that worries about, is London accelerating my kids'
too far?
Could I keep them in a state of being innocent and playing and having fun if I took them elsewhere?
Yeah, it's true, isn't it? I don't know. I think it's all about boredom, isn't it? I mean, I wonder if, in terms of that, whether maybe you're more likely to be bored in a small market town miles away from anywhere and then sort seek out whatever it is to amuse yourselves, whereas, at, you know, drugs or porn or all that kind of thing, you know? And, you know, and actually, if you're in London and you're lucky enough to be in a kind of loving family and have good friends around you and the right people around you, that maybe, I don't know, that's wishful thinking on my part, but I'm not sure we particularly, and obviously this was a long time ago, but I'm not sure if we necessarily matured in terms of naughtiness more quickly than our contemporaries.
But it was fundamentally harder to be naughty when we were young.
Yes,
the accessibility of naughtiness is prevalent now, and you know the idea. There was a, you know, John Ronson's Butterfly Effect podcast, you know, which brilliantly examines what free porn on the internet has done to society, the really horrible stories of, I think they had something as young as 6 who was on the sex offenders register because they'd displayed overtly sexual behaviour after watching porn, and you know, and so many stories about children being sexualized and you know, rushed into adulthood just from experiences of a classmate,
and also
Vaughan.
Completely defining their idea, because they see that before they have any experience, so it defines what they think. A friend of mine has a theory, and this big qualifier, she's not talking about everybody, and but her daughter was going through some sort of trans issues and questioning it, and so she was talking a lot to her daughter and her daughter's friends, and she believed that a lot of what was confusing them came from things like pornography. So if you're a young girl and you see every pornographic scene is, I love the fact that we've narrowed to porn, but every pornographic scene is like, you know, a guy taking a girl up the arse and she's loving it, and every porn actress is absolutely loving it. Then if your first, and lots of young girls' first experience of sex is anal sex, and then, oh, I don't enjoy it, I must be, there must be something, you know, I'm not straight, or I'm not, you know, this, I'm not interested in sex, or whatever, whatever. I'm not saying that's oversimplistic, and there's loads of people that that does not apply to, but it sort of made sense, you know, these, it's really pernicious, and that, that kind of thing, you know, if that, you can see how you would go down that road, totally.
We are essentially blowing our kids' minds, like, in many ways, you know, I mean, there's a reason why, for instance, there's this huge boom in energy drinks and iced coffees. You see that now, the supermarket's just being full and full of different brands of both these things. It's because we're all tired, we're all stressed, wired. Yeah. And now these things are being pushed down on the kids. You know, so I saw a kid of probably about 5 in a buggy drinking a can of Red Bull. And you know, just giving our kids iPads and phones and constantly bombarding them with this stimuli, this blue light coming at them, and of course the porn thing. There's so many different ways in which kids are just being overwhelmed by stuff now. You know, we just didn't have you know, managed to make it into our. Well, you know, I didn't have a mobile phone until after university. You know, like, we made it through childhood without all those pressures and those worries. So, yeah, if you want to sort of zone in on one big anxiety for parents, it is that thing about your kids being torn out of childhood.
Talking about technology and social media and things like that, we were talking before I started recording about how you approach that, and how do you mention your kids, and how much do you mention your kids? What's that? How does that work for you? Is that a conversation you have with yourself?
No, I don't really have the conversation myself. Other people have the conversation with me. I'm a big poster of things that my children say that make me laugh on social media. And I have, not many, I have to say, but I have, some people have said to me, like, oh, are you sure? You know, aren't your kids going to, you know, they don't really give their permission for that. And, you know, aren't they going to regret it later in life? And I don't know. I don't post really personal things. I don't post sort of anything that feels like emotionally awkward or whatever. I post things that have made me laugh.
They're funny. And they usually have, I think, well, from reading your posts, they tend to have a lot of the time it's often Leo has some kind of actually quite funny insight or kind of brilliant way of demolishing, you know, what we all think to be true or something like that. I think the time you might feel uncomfortable about it, which wouldn't be with you, is when people, I don't know, would share a kind of naivety of their kid or something that you just feel like, well, that could be embarrassing for them as a teenager to know that you shared that.
I mean, Leah has these brilliant philosophical moments, like, Daddy, when will pirates stop roaming?
Yeah.
or on a scale of 1 to 1,000, what do you think of art? And I don't know. I mean, I feel like if it... I see him. I guess this is, you know, me projecting onto them, but, you know, I am a comedian, a comedy writer, and I see them as little comedians, you know. They're kind of coming out with these funny lines and sometimes being quite aware that they're saying something funny. And I'm taking pleasure in that and enjoying it. And I guess in a worst-case scenario, as an adult, they'll say, like, oh, you were having a laugh at my expense. You were kind of mocking me. And my response will always be, no, I was laughing with you. I was enjoying it.
I think also because it's often with those questions that you're seeing a brain working its way into the sense of the world. So it helps you. I mean, I said something recently that my son said, which was, he just turned to me very earnestly and said, it's Halloween, then it's Christmas, then we die. And I was thinking, oh shit. And that made me not laugh at him, but realise that, oh, actually, I do talk about death quite a lot. Quite a lot. And he's got it into his head. Are we going to die? That when, you know, I thought, maybe I need to back off that a little bit, you know. But that was, it's his brain going, okay, I'm putting all this together, and Halloween is maybe a little bit about that. So that's in my head, and, you know, and then it's Christmas, and all I care about is Christmas. And then he's just kind of put all these thoughts together, and the way he's arranged them is really interesting and kind of informative.
Totally.
But funny.
I mean, they can be heartbreaking in their way, can't they? But they often definitely do make you think of things in a different way and force you to challenge your own thinking.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think that I have improved as a writer as a result of having children.
In what way?
I feel like, well, in two ways. I feel like, firstly, that it opened me up in a different way emotionally, and I felt like I could now understand parent-child relationships from the other side,
mm-hmm.
and particularly that bond between a father and a child, which mm-hmm. I find myself writing about a lot. I think probably because I have a very bad relationship with my own dad,
right.
and he's been very kind of estranged and distant from my life, and I feel like there's probably always been a little part of me wanting that paternal approval and sort of seeking the father's love and admiration, whatever.
Yeah.
And I've written a lot of things about parents and fathers and sons, and, you know, Rudy's Rare Records that I wrote for Radio 4 was about three generations, where you had, you know, the grandfather, the father and the son, and so you had two different father-son relationships. And, you know, last year I did a play, Under the Pier, about a father and son pair of comedians, you know, and I think I keep coming back to these kind of slightly warring father-son relationships where there's some underlying love but a lot of sort of spikiness. So I guess, you know, I understood father-son relationships in a different way and could write about them in a deeper way, I guess. But then also just, I think that, you know, this brilliant, innate kind of ground zero humour of children shapes you as well, you know, and the beautiful lines they come out with, the way they make you look at the world, and the fact that I've become interested in things I never imagined I would be interested in, like military aircraft and trains and dinosaurs, you know, or maybe rediscovering things that I liked as a kid. But I think all of that piles in and shapes you, and, you know, shapes your imagination. And if you're someone who fundamentally lives off and earns a living out of your imagination, then two other people in the house who are feeding that imagination, that's a good thing.
Yeah, completely. In terms of, you were talking about your relationship with your father, did that make it sort of easier or more difficult to kind of find how you wanted to be as a father, if you know what I mean? We were talking a bit about, you know, you either kind of rebel against what you've had, or you know, did that make it easier to listen to Eva, for instance, when you suddenly thought, oh, hang on, this isn't quite how it is?
Yes, I think probably in terms of that specific point, yes. I think that I always, from the very beginning, had a thing of, I don't want to be like my dad. And in some ways that's probably unfair, because I think, according to my mum, he was a good dad at the beginning, and when we were young he was a good dad.
Mm.
And then I think he sort of lost his way, and he left when I was 13, and, you know, there's a lot of kind of problematic things from that point on, affairs and having a child that he never told us about, you know, discovering that he had a child when she was about 4 and a half, and all sorts of very emotionally complicated things. And, you know, since then my relationship has been very distant, really. But so I felt like I didn't want to be like my dad, and that's good in some ways, I guess, in giving you a kind of model of, you know, I want to be a good dad.
Yeah.
But it's also a big pressure to put on yourself.
Yes, I think.
And so you catch moments where, like, you're shouting at your kids and you're going, like, oh, is that what my dad would have done?
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to be an irascible dad. You know, most of my memories of my dad are of him being irascible and shouting, throwing my Asterix plastic lunchbox across a room and breaking on the buckles on it, you know.
Yeah.
You know, or being very anxious. He was somebody who was an anxious, neurotic person with some strange phobias. And, you know, I have lots of memories of being, like, in a car on a motorway. One of his phobias was the motorway, and being in a car of him and him being incredibly, you know, tense and anxious, and loads of things which impacted on the relationship. And I think I went through a period of anxiety at university, and I went to see a psychologist on the NHS, and she said to me, "Were your parents anxious?" And I said, "Oh, no, I don't think so." And I went, "Actually, hang on. Yeah, you know, and my dad had a nervous breakdown. In fact, several nervous breakdowns. Was very phobic, and my mum is quite an anxious person." So, oh yeah, I did. And yeah. I started thinking about how I'd grown up in this culture of anxiety, and I talked to my brother about it recently, and we were like, yeah, like, no, it really was kind of quite an anxious, stressful place to grow up, and that definitely does project onto you. And you have this desperate desire not to be an anxious parent and not to project things onto your kids. There's a really fascinating theory about the impact of the Second World War, and about how the impact of the Second World War on the generation of people who fought in it, who were, you know, our parents' age, you know, has had this impact that drips down through generations. Yeah. And, you know, my granddad was somebody who served as a doctor in the 8th Army, and he was at the heart of the worst fighting in Italy, sort of, you know, kind of some of the most brutal, bloody fighting of the Second World War, and was a broken man afterwards. You know, he was depressed and essentially almost housebound after that point, had ECT therapy and all sorts. Yeah. And undoubtedly, growing up with a very depressed person like that, sort of, you know, mentally ill person like that, had an effect on my mum.
Yeah.
And she is an anxious person. Yeah. And she found another anxious person in my dad.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, some of that anxiety does come down onto my generation. Yeah. And, you know, will it go down to the next, you know? And
it's incredible, isn't it? Incredible. My mother's father had her quite late. He was at the Battle of the Somme. He returned. So the First World War, but again, returned a, you know, broken man. And I still don't really, my mother and all her siblings just had a sort of, anger in them and a weirdness in them, which sort of makes them brilliant and tricky, you know, that you just think must stem from that. And then, you know, so it trickles down in different ways. And then, and flip-flops as well, you know, where my mum was quite strict and tough. And I am, as a consequence, a completely sort of marshmallow parent who sometimes I kind of look at my kids standing on tables and screaming and thinking, oh, this is, you know, my mother would hate this and I've gone the other way. But that's still an effect. You know, that's just the opposite, you know. But
we are very binary as people, aren't we? Particularly in the age of Twitter where everything is love or hate, you know. But we see things in opposites, you know. So if your parents were one way, you become the opposite. You know, you grew up in a strict house, you will give your kid loads of sweets.
Yeah. You know? But that's not necessarily freeing yourself from the effect of an opposite thing. Yeah, absolutely.
I think I see that as well in how you treat kids when you've got two kids as well. You see things in terms of opposites.
Yes, yes.
You know, so you had
she's
a calm,
like that, he's not like that. Yeah.
Calm first kid, then the second kid's going to be a nightmare.
Yeah.
And I wonder how much we project onto them and shape them, push them into those roles.
Totally. How was having a second child to you? How did that change things?
Well, a good friend of mine, just before we had the second kid, said to me, the difference between having one and two is the difference between owning a pet and owning a zoo. And it's,
oh, Christ.
It's one of the truest things anybody ever said to me in parenting terms. I felt like the leap up from one to two was just like nothing I could have expected. I mean, it made me feel like the shift into having a child at the beginning was just nothing compared to that.
Yes, I know, yeah.
And it's terrible, but I find myself now looking at people with one child and kind of going, you're not a proper parent. You know, you don't know what it's like,
man.
Yeah,
you don't know
you weren't there.
I see, because we had ours really close together. So we didn't even ever really have much time with Zach on his own. So we had very little time as parents of one. And I look at people, it's a bit less now because often those people have had more children, but I look at people who, I used to look at people who had like two parents with a two-year-old, and they'd just be, I'd see them sort of sitting at a table and eating a meal. And it was, seemed really calm. And they were both parents who had sort of talking to the child and having conversations. And I just think, oh my God. I mean, like, this is just this sweet beauty of what's going, you know, I was so jealous. Yeah.
We had 3.5 years with Leo before Max was born. And I remember thinking he was essentially an adult. I remember having these conversations with him. But he just seemed so grown up. And, you know, I remember he was probably about 2.5. We were on holiday and he composed a song. It was called the Mayonnaise Song, and it went mayonnaise, 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 mayonnaise. And I just thinking, here is this fully formed creative being,
yes,
who's like, you know, pontificating on philosophical subjects and coming up with songs, and then I don't know, and then Max was born, and then you can't focus on child one as much, and so you're not kind of as on their development as you were.
Yeah.
And then second child, you're just kind of neglecting, but you're not kind of as on them as well. You know, you kind of constantly feel guilty about neglecting either child one, child two, your partner, your job, or yourself, whatever. Yeah. And then, I don't know, and then now Max, you know, age 3 and a half now, the age, you know, sort of, you know, I mean, Leo, you know, his whole repertoire of music, whatever. But like, Max feels younger now, but
yes,
I don't think he is. I think it's just as a parent of a first child, you're constantly projecting. And I think as a parent, you kind of, you have all these things in your head of like milestones you want to hit based on your own childhood.
Yes.
And like, actually, a lot of these things happened when you were 8, 9, 10.
Yeah, yeah.
But when you have your first child, you're thinking like, oh, got to do this, got to watch Star Wars, and got to, you know,
got to go camping,
you know, all these kind of things. And you're kind of realizing you're rushing it. And then the second child, you kind of realize, oh, actually, no, that they're just a small baby. They're kind of, you know, it's different. It's different.
It's a huge. You don't have the. I think, what I noticed is just no breaks. There were no breaks. There was, with your first child, you have breaks, either with a nap or, you know, there are times where they're happy or doing something and then you can do something. And with two, there's just no break.
You know, you never get things right, do you? But I feel some guilt about Max when he was very young, the second child. I feel like he did get a bit neglected. And I think we got so lulled into kind of loving Leo and all his creativity. And so we ended up focusing a little bit too much on him sometimes and thinking like, oh, a baby can look after themselves.
Yes.
It's fine. And I think that I've seen big shifts in Max since, for instance, I started taking a day off a week to be with him every week and taking him swimming. And there was a really massive moment, which sounds trivial, but felt seismic, which was, Max had really long, unkempt hair, quite wild hair, and we liked it because we thought, oh, he's a little sweet baby with long, crazy hair, sort of Einstein-esque kind of hair flying out. And we took him for a haircut, and then he looked at himself in the mirror afterwards, and I felt like this was this moment where he'd had something for himself, you know, it was a sort of special thing for him.
Yeah.
But he was also looking and seeing a boy rather than a baby, and his behaviour just changed radically from that point, and he started being, he'd been quite, in some ways, kind of quite a wild baby, kind of very vocal, very loud, screaming and shouting, and sometimes kind of a bit violent, and I felt like we've started moving into this thing of him being a calmer personality.
Do you think you changed your behaviour towards him as well a bit?
I think we started to realise
that... Because you're seeing him, because I think that I might have done that.
I think, in a way, I think the fact that he was being a bit violent and kind of a bit of a destructive kid was making us realise that actually there's going to be reasons behind this.
And
he was feeling a bit neglected. He was feeling a bit out of the family mix sometimes. And, you know, if you're sitting having dinner together in the evening and the conversation is all between three members of the family and there's one member of the family sitting there by himself and everyone's kind of like, oh, it's fine. He's not really talking yet. He's not really, you know, whatever. Then that kid's going to feel left out.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's funny because also I think your kids are you'll never know how much is their sort of what they've inherited and is down to circumstance. Because my daughter is equally, you know, when she was born, Zach was 13 months, so it was just, you know, mayhem. And but she's her the way she's dealt with that is to be incredibly independent and kind of brilliant at playing on her own and, you know, very good at, you know, she's probably the Swedish child, has made lots of friends at nursery, you know, she's kind of, you know, and I know it's going to come back and bite us in the butt, you know, but at the moment it's kind of made her this, it's actually given her greater gifts than Zach in a weird way, because she's quite, I don't know how much of that she would have had anyway.
The second child definitely benefits from you learning from your mistakes.
Yeah,
and, you know, being able to
lack of anxiety around the baby.
Yeah, I think that helps a lot. But also just like, you know, if your kid went to a nursery and you weren't entirely satisfied with it, you can send your second child to a better nursery.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, all these kind of things that you learn along the way. I don't know. I feel like it's just crazy having two kids, isn't it? It's really, really hard work. And you have to keep reminding yourself to do certain things. You have to remind yourself to spend time with your partner, to go out on a date night, to do those things. You have to remind yourself to just make time to be silly with your kids, because particularly now for me, like getting one to school, one to nursery, it feels like there's a lot of time where I'm being a sergeant major shouting at these kids, going, come on, get your socks on, get out the house, why don't you have your bag? You know?
Yeah.
And just actually spending a bit of time just being silly, pretending to be a monster.
Yeah.
Or doing funny voices. And it really reaps, you know, real massive rewards.
It's so true. It's Kirsten O'Brien, I interviewed a few weeks ago, and she said exactly that, say yes more. Which was that thing of, I've thought about that a lot, actually.
I was walking back with Max, my youngest, the other day from dropping Lee off at school. And we're trying to get back so that his grandparents who were staying could take him swimming. And so there was a bit of a time limit involved. And he was just wanting to stop all the time. And I was like, come on, let's go. And then at one point, he sat down in this kind of fairly ropey, horrible kind of flower bed just at the top of one of the streets near us, you know, which is sort of not that well looked after, possibly from a dog poo. And he sort of knelt down. He went, I'm in the jungle. And I was like, okay, I've got to go with this, you know. I'm not going to say, come on, you're not in the jungle, get back home.
Yeah.
I was like, what are you doing? Who are you? And he was like, I'm a panther, you know. And, you know, it's moments like that that you have to enjoy, because they're not going to last forever. There's going to be a point where your kids don't want to be with you.
Exactly.
And you know, off looking at porn.
Maybe with your kids.
But... I'm too busy looking at porn, Dad.
The worst advice you've ever had, or the worst sort of comment anyone made to you when you've had?
Well, yes, I've thought about this, and I don't know if I've had any really bad advice. It was more bad examples, I think.
Right.
And I think that does come back to that thing of watching other dads. And I think I saw a lot of other dads who gave me the sense that your life could remain unchanged and that you could just keep being the guy who went out the door every morning and didn't really have to look after the kids at all,
and that was what you were aiming for, you know, that was the best thing
that was kind of the way things worked. And and it harks back to a very outdated model of fatherdom that hasn't really been exorcised from the British psyche. It has in Sweden, I think, but it hasn't been from the British psyche. And so I think it was more bad examples rather than bad advice. But also, I mean, I think people are rushing to give you advice when you're a dad, when you're running around with a baby in the early days. And so, you know, I felt like people, like old ladies, would feel perfectly legitimized to just lean over and sort of say to me, like, you know, oh, you know, he's crying, you know, I'm not sure you're looking after him properly, you know.
Yeah.
Like the woman
insane... Although I bet no one actually said, I'm not sure you're looking after him properly, but that's what you heard.
Well, the woman in Sainsbury's checkout, I had Max, my youngest, and he was really crying really, really loudly. But that was just what he did. He was a very loud baby.
Yeah.
You know, I think, you know, isn't there something about a baby's cry being louder than an airplane taking off? So I'm sure I read that.
Oh my God.
Who knows? But
certainly
anyway,
feels
but
like
she
it.
Said to me, this child is in distress. You know, you need to do something about it. And I was like, no, he's just hungry. This is what he does. He's a bit hungry. Yeah. I'm packing my shopping as quickly as I can. We're going to go back and mummy's going to feed him, you know. And she was like, no. Trust me, that is a child in distress.
Wow.
And, you know, this is not right. And it felt like kind of really kind of a bit out of order that she should be piling in that way. And I don't think she would have done that with her mother. You know, I think it was this idea that the dad was kind of out of control.
Oh, I see what you mean. That he didn't, you didn't realise.
Your dad didn't know what to do.
Yeah, right.
And I've heard other dads say things like, you know, someone coming up and saying to them, you know, you need to wipe your child's nose, you know. I definitely think that, and also that whole thing about... are you babysitting your child? You know, and I had a lot of people getting quite bothered about the idea of a dad staying in with the kids being babysitting a mum. It's just being a parent.
Yes, exactly. Well, it's the same with people with drop-offs and stuff. You know, David drops the kids off in the morning and is sort of like, oh, isn't he amazing? you know, and then I always go, yes, and I pick them up. Mm.
No, I think so, that's the plus side, you know, for dads, that yeah, you know, if you do even basic things, it's like, you know.
Yeah, you get, oh, you're a superhero.
You know, it's exactly. Like, you know, that Chris Rock routine, you know, I won't say the word, it's, you know, the N-word.
Business, oh, right, so yeah,
says,
yeah.
You know, and he says, you know, I look after my kids, you know, and that, he's like, that's what you're meant to do, you know.
Yeah.
And it's very true, though, with dads, like, you know, there's a whole thing about, like, you know, I take my kids to school, you know, that's what you're meant to do.
Yeah.
I get up and like to feed them. Yes, you're meant to, you're a parent, you know. Sadly, fatherdom is full of bad examples.
That's
normally your own father. Yeah. I meet so many people who've got bad relationships with their dads, and you desperately, desperately hope that that won't be the case.
Yeah.
Moving forward.
Yeah.
I feel like things are changing. I see a lot more examples
Definitely. Now
of dads who are working maybe 4-day weeks and just being around a lot more.
I also think, I think what you're saying is completely right, but I also think that there's a lack of realism for both men and women as well, in terms of an expectation that you can have children and you can still, you know, have a completely unchanged career, social life, wealth, like that the ideal is that children don't have any impact on your life. And actually that's not, shouldn't be our, I mean, in my mind, it shouldn't be our ideal. Of course, you know, children have a hugely positive impact on your life, in that everything then takes its place. And I think both men and women can be guilty of that. I think it's much, you know, the societal press, you know, the expectation of men is much less than of women, and that's a huge issue. But I also think that that's a little bit shared.
No, I think that's true. I think I spent about 4 years, maybe even slightly longer, wanting children to have no impact on my life.
Yeah.
And now I spend a lot of time delighting in the impact they have.
Yeah.
And I really enjoy the fact that I go swimming on a Monday morning with Max, and that you know, I'm able to pick the kids up and drop them off, and you know, the days when you pick them up a little bit earlier and you spend a bit more time together. And,
I remember feeling quite keenly when our kids were babies, and knowing that there was going to be a point in 20 years where we were negotiating with our children to have dinner with them. Do you know what I mean? That we were going, it will be really quick. It's a great new restaurant. We'll just, you know, just kind of like, you know, yeah, you yeah. just think, well, yeah. that's what it's going to be. By the time we
rush off to some hipster.
Yeah, exactly. They're just like, okay,
God,
fine.
So boring.
Yeah, exactly.
I absolutely crave the idea of having a good relationship with your kids when you're grown up. That, you know, sometimes you see a little post on Facebook of a family that just clearly just love each other as adults. You know, like they're all together. And they're like just so sadly, I feel like now actually I've moved into a thing where I often see this in the context of a parent having died. You know, and a child talking about having lost their parent, but just that incredible idea of this close bond that goes throughout life, and that you're still having fun doing things together.
Yes.
Like, you know, I don't go fishing, but the idea of like going fishing together, that'd be lovely, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
You know, or just, you know, hanging out together as adults. I'd love that.
What advice would you give to someone who was just about to have a baby, or maybe a second child?
Well, I think the best advice I've received is everything is a phase. And I don't know if that's kind of shifted its way into being a kind of parental cliche, but it's so true. And you have so many moments in life where it seems insurmountable, and you just think your child is never going to sleep, or your child is always going to be the awkward, shy one at parties, or it's always going to be the one who throws wooden toys in the face of other children at parties, you know. and everything is a phase. Everything has its moment where it feels awful and worrying, and that you should call a child psychologist, or, you know, go and talk to the teacher, and then things change and things move along. And I think that's key to remember, and that sometimes you need to be active in helping it out of that phase. Sometimes there are things you've got to do, you've got to go and sort of, you know, do things, you've got to seek advice or whatever, but you know, don't get locked into thinking my kid is this way.
Thank you so much to Danny Robbins for coming to talk to me. Now, we talked about why Scandinavians leave their babies outside, and I looked it up, and apparently most parents think it's very good to give your children fresh air, and they also claim that they sleep much longer outside than inside. I think Danny's right, there may not be any scientific fact behind that, but it's been going on for generations and, you know, they're fine, aren't they? While I was editing this interview, our new lovely au pair walked in just as I was talking about children watching porn and seeing women take it up the arse. And then she quietly walked out again. Somehow I'm going to have to navigate that conversation and explain what I was doing listening to a recording of myself having that conversation. Anyway, I will leave that with you. I hope you have a good few weeks. I'm not entirely sure. I've got a few in the bank. I'm not entirely sure who I'm going to release in a couple of weeks. But he/she will be brilliant. Look after yourself till then. And thanks for listening.
Bye-bye.